Music Made Me, The Alan Schiller Story. Adapted in two parts for audio by Tony Staveaker and Alan Harris. Part 2. Practice, practice, practice. At the Moscow Tchaikovsky Conservatoire during the height of the Cold War, Schiller's piano trio prepare for the day when they'll go on the road. Things will be much different on his return to Russia, some 20 years on.
The conservatoire administrators didn't seem to know how long I would be there, so couldn't actually allocate me to a course either as a full-time student or as a postgraduate. In addition to the language class, I was put in the chamber music class of Konstantin Kristoforovich Adjemov. Chamber music was a joy. Konstantin Kristoforovich was one of the sweetest men imaginable, and molded Manuel, my Mexican violinist, Stefan Popov, the Bulgarian cellist, and myself into a fine piano trio. And we were gaining a large and enthusiastic following whenever we played at concerts in the small hall. When we were asked to take part in a concert in Klin, a town about 50 miles from Moscow, we were overjoyed. How we practiced! We even went into the conservatoire at 6:30 in the morning, and we soon had the Mendelssohn D minor trio well under our fingers. The day arrived, and we, along with three or four other students, caught the train to Klin. We were all in our best suits and shoes, but our smart appearance was not to last. Spring was in the air, and the snow was melting, and we had to trudge from Klin station to the concert venue through slush and sludge. Then we found out that we were playing in a school instead of a concert hall, and we had to file through all the assembled school children and take up station facing them. The next instruction was to announce where we came from and that we brought greetings to the children of the USSR from our own country. This brought rapturous applause for the Cuban, Mexican and Bulgarian, but my greeting was met with hardly a murmur. The Cold War was obviously alive and well in Klin. The final straw was that I was expected to play on a battered school upright piano, which made the Mendelssohn trio almost impossible to perform. And that was our much-anticipated concert in Klin. Inevitably, the main centre of our student life was the Conservatoire. I don't think it is an exaggeration to state that the Tchaikovsky Conservatoire at that time was at the top of the International League of Music Academies. The list of names of the teachers there was so impressive, all giants of the music world. Mstislav Rostropovich was the most charismatic of them all, and he was the teacher with whom I would spend most time, other than Merzhanov, during my years in Moscow. This came about through my association with the cellist, Stefan Popov. Stefan needed an accompanist for a series of recitals he was due to give in January 1963 in Bulgaria. I was lucky to be partnering Stefan when we played the Prokofiev Sonata in class for Slava, as Rostropovich was known to all. The lessons we had with him were so inspiring. He would draw sounds from the cello and indeed from the piano like no one else. His larger-than-life personality shone through the music, and after a lesson with him, you came away feeling that anything was possible. In addition to these wonderful qualities, he switched effortlessly from cello to piano to demonstrate passages to us, and all without the printed music. His memory was phenomenal, and displayed to no greater effect than in early 1964, when he gave a series of 7 concerto concerts in the big hall of the Conservatoire. Each evening featured 3 or 4 works, some hot off the printing press. The final concert included his playing the solo cello part in Don Quixote by Strauss and the cello symphony by Benjamin Britten. The conductor was Britten himself. What a privilege to be in an audience for those remarkable concerts. As a person, Slava's exuberance and warmth were overwhelming. For us young students, it was an honour just to be in his presence. He had a naughty sense of humour, which was illustrated on the occasion when he was rehearsing the Brahms Double Concerto with David Oistrakh, one of the greatest violinists of the 20th century. Slava asked Stefan, who was listening in the hall, whether the balance between the instruments was okay. Stefan said, "You were a bit louder than Maestro Oistrakh." "I know, Stefcho, I know," he replied, with a twinkle in his eye. Slava invited me and Stefan to his flat one morning, and as we were chatting away, his wife Galina appeared in her bathrobe, hair in curlers, and made it clear to him that visitors were not welcome. He very meekly saw us out. We had learnt who wore the trousers in that household. The Conservatoire on Herzen Street was located in the left wing of a large building which was dominated by the Grand Hall of the Conservatoire. This was Moscow's main concert hall. The wing also housed the small hall where student recitals and chamber music performances were usually held. You climbed a flight of stairs to the reception and cloakrooms, which were manned by elderly ladies like our déjeuners. They took a great interest in the students, and when they got to know and grew to like you, they would slip into the concerts you were taking part in to listen. And I remember one of them telling me that a button was loose on my overcoat and insisting on sewing it on for me. Another granny for me. Your lessons were generally open to all staff and students. Members of the public could also attend. It was polite to ask permission to listen, but seats were arranged around the room and you would be made welcome. The professors attracting most audiences were Neuhaus and Oistrakh. Neuhaus, then quite an old man, had been the teacher of Richter and Gilels, and there were at least 30 people in the room when I attended one of his lessons. The two moments I recall were his dancing around the room to the opening of the finale of Beethoven's Emperor Concerto, and then a pupil playing some Bach. Not very impressed, he asked the boy if he had read the Bible. "No," was the response. Neuhaus sighed and said, "Then you won't understand Bach." The conservatoire was sometimes obliged to take in students for political reasons. An outstanding example was Ahmed, introduced to me by my flatmate, Fuad. Ahmed was a lovely character, whose chief talent seemed to lie in picking up Russian girls. He came to Moscow with no background musical training whatever, and sought my advice on which instrument he should learn. I went through the problems of all the instruments before suggesting that he could avoid years of practice by becoming a composer. I felt quite pleased with this joking, Solomon-like advice, but at the end of the year he asked me to play the piece he had composed for his exam. It was almost impossible to keep a straight face as I umpcha-umpcha-chaed my way through the primitive work in front of eminent professors. Served me right. Away from the classrooms, the canteen was the social hub. The less said about the food, the better. There was a menu of sorts, but more than half of the items would be marked "niet," and the rest would be fairly inedible. My favourites were the cheese pancakes, but everything was greasy and lukewarm, and the soups were disgusting. But it was the place to sit and chat, not only with your own friends, but with students from the other faculties. I got 90 rubles a month from the Munster Trust for my living expenses. 2.5 rubles to the English pound was the official rate, although you could get 5 rubles on the black market. I was comfortably off with that allowance, because all tuition fees were paid by the Soviet authorities. I was able to afford regular hotel and restaurant meals, and these could be surprisingly tasty, particularly the chicken Kiev and the chocolate cake, but you often had to wait an age for them to arrive at your table. Arriving there in winter of 1962 confirmed my impression of Moscow as a grey and gloomy city. Mounds of snow stretched along the roadside, and pavements were treacherous with packed snow trodden into an icy surface. There were poorly illuminated shop windows with their pyramids of the same single can, and the citizens trudging along the pavements in dark, heavy overcoats and fur hats. Many snow shifters and road diggers were women, doing very heavy work bundled up in their heavy winter clothing. I remember that all shop staff were female, as were all the telephone operators and even bus and tram drivers. Many were far from young. All the foreign students in our flats communicated in Russian, some much more fluent than others. Certainly those from the Eastern Bloc were streets ahead, having had lessons in school. Some of us occasionally caused amusement with misuse of a word. I, for example, once told someone I was looking forward to my next punishment instead of performance. Fuad went skiing one day and tried to warn people to get out of his way. "Обязательно, обязательно!" "Definitely, definitely," he cried, instead of "Осторожно, осторожно!" "Look out, look out!" On another occasion, he asked a girl out to the window, "Окно," instead of to the cinema, "Кино." But there was also the unspoken fear of saying or doing something to upset the regime. Police stood at every corner, so at least you felt safe. But I do remember a time when a serial killer was on the loose and causing a general scare in the city. He was gaining entrance to apartments by purporting to be from the Moscow gas department. He was eventually caught. Certainly, as foreign students, we felt the need to take care about what we said about living conditions, both amongst ourselves and in our letters home. I felt sure that my letters to my parents must have been checked, at least for the first few weeks. I too felt I must take care not to offend my hosts, so there was always a quick glance over the shoulder before saying anything that could be rated offensive. On my first visit home, I encountered my first copy of Private Eye on a British newsstand. I was wary of buying it, in case it was in some way to do with espionage. Sadly, there was also a degree of fear of Muscovites associating with foreigners, and this resulted in only a very small number of invitations to Russians' homes. I myself turned down a couple, as I was suspicious of their motives. They could well have been KGB trying to lure me into doing something inappropriate. The one that I distinctly remember accepting was to a girlfriend's flat, where she had reassured me that, since her father was a diplomat, conditions there, and the catering, would be of a suitably high standard. The accommodation provided to party members and the goods they had access to were of a considerably higher quality than those available to the man in the street. Despite all the anti-Western propaganda, the more enlightened realised how low, compared to the West, was their standard of living. But the propaganda in the press and on the radio was incessant. Colonialist Britain and the American militarist aggressors were attacked daily, and this was backed by the intensive political teaching that started in kindergarten and continued even into the workplace. I was surprised how important passing political exams was, even in a music institution. Soviet workers had no incentive to do a good job because they had no share in the state's factory or shop. So stories of corruption and theft were rife, and the quality of goods produced was extremely poor. Soviet goods, such as radios or record players, would never be purchased if there were East German alternatives on sale. Similarly, clothes were shoddy, and I was able to sell sweaters in the commission shop for more than 10 times the cost in England. To supplement my finances, I would bring Marks and Spencer t-shirts from home, and if I took them to the state commission shop, they would sell them for me, for as much as 40 rubles each. On the other hand, music and books were very cheap, and I was able to build up a wonderful library of orchestral scores, sheet music, and Russian literature. Art books published in East Germany were of the highest quality, and, before the Sino-Soviet split in 1963, some Chinese volumes appeared in the main store on Gorky Street. Here I was introduced, through translation, to the works of Dostoevsky, Pushkin, and Chekhov. There were also books by Western authors in the bookshops, if their views were sufficiently left-wing. Dickens certainly passed that test. At no time was any attempt made to turn me towards communism, but, as someone said to me, how can they even try when you are here to witness its lack of success? Although I had no political leanings, I was certainly not drawn to communism. But living there for such a long time made me aware that many of us in the West had more material goods than was necessary for a happy life. The only English newspaper available was the Daily Worker, which later became the Morning Star. I bought that for the football results. I didn't bother to purchase Pravda or Izvestia. I found it virtually impossible to translate the long political tracts, and news broadcasts were rattled off too fast for my basic Russian. On rereading my letters home and entries in a diary that I kept during my first months, I'm surprised at what an interesting social life I led, despite working so hard. I had been told to get in touch with Dodi Tryggvason, who was an Icelandic pianist. She had been a student at the conservatoire, where she had met and recently married a young Russian pianist called Vladimir, known as Vovo, Ashkenazi. Vovo was to become one of the greatest artists of his generation, both as pianist and conductor. They met up with me and kindly invited me over to the flat where they lived with his parents, a small gesture, but one that meant a lot to me in those early days. In September 1962, I described an excursion which was arranged by Yuri Kurpiakov. I wrote, "It was a terrific success, though I still don't know where we went. Our first stop was at an old palace, and if we'd explored it, I'm sure it would have been very interesting. But instead, we organised a football match. It was so odd that I feel like writing it up for the Yorkshire Evening Post. We had 10 nationalities playing. The game was endless, with no referee, and nobody knows who won." Being the only English student at the conservatoire, there were also some at Moscow State University, I was taken under the wing of the British Embassy and invited to functions and parties. The ambassador when I first arrived was Sir Frank Roberts, and he and his wife kindly invited me to lunch soon after my arrival. The embassy building was a beautiful mansion directly opposite the Kremlin, on a boulevard called Sofiskaya Naborezhnaya. The main problem in getting there was my feeble attempt to pronounce the address to a taxi driver before knowing any Russian. It was a luncheon to welcome a group of public school heads, including a headmaster of rugby and Dame Rita Harris, who was on the board of the National Youth Orchestra. Later, I was privileged to meet members of the Royal Shakespeare Company when they toured King Lear and the Comedy of Errors. Paul Scofield, Ian Richardson and Diana Rigg were members of the company. All the embassy staff were always hospitable, and invitations came frequently from them to dinners, cocktails and dances, as well as the Queen's birthday parties. Just before Christmas 1962, a new British ambassador arrived in Moscow. His name was Sir Humphrey Trevelyan. He was a great man and became a good friend to me. He came to Moscow from his previous posting as ambassador in Tehran. He introduced himself to me at the embassy Christmas party by telling me that he was a keen amateur pianist. He said there was a grand piano at the embassy and that if I was willing to go in to play with him, he would hire a second piano so that we could play repertoire for four hands on two pianos as well as piano duets. I readily agreed, and in the new year I was invited in one Sunday afternoon. On a long table in the centre of the drawing room, he had set out his substantial music collection, Bach transcriptions, Mozart and Schubert duets, and French two piano scores. For a couple of hours we played, stopped for a glass of whiskey, played another hour, and then retired to the kitchen, where his wife Peggy had left us a bite of supper. This ritual was repeated whenever we had a free Sunday, and on one notable occasion, as we finished quite late, he insisted on sending me back to my humble lodgings in the Embassy Rolls-Royce. I chuckled to think what watching eyes must have made of that. Presumably the KGB were informed. Just before I left Moscow in June 1964, Sir Humphrey arranged a farewell dinner in my honour, to which he invited not only a number of cultural attachés from other embassies, but also my professor, who had to seek permission to attend, and Stefan, my fellow student. After a short recital, we enjoyed a superb meal followed by brandy and cigars. I will be grateful forever for the kindness and generosity shown to me by Sir Humphrey. Another important role the embassy played was in supplying student flats with toilet paper. They were perhaps unaware that when I waited in their reception room, I would surreptitiously secrete an airmail edition of The Times under my heavy sheepskin coat and smuggle it out. It gained me many friends in the flat, as it was so much kinder to the skin than Pravda. The other great asset was being able to use the embassy shop. Although I was limited to spending £1 per month, it's incredible to realise what £1 could buy in 1962. I would have enough jam, marmalade, soup and baked beans to last me until the next visit. Later on, I could buy a few items, including butter and cigarettes, from the American Embassy through my friend Malcolm. At first, the cigarettes were given, or bartered, to my friends, until I finally succumbed and took to the weed myself. The contact with the American Embassy was of great social benefit because of their film evenings and friendships that I made. The number of lovely Scandinavian au pair girls was an added attraction. All students were expected to take part in concerts throughout the term. Internal ones took place in the small hall of the conservatoire. They might be designated class concerts, given by pupils of one professor, faculty concerts, quite an honour to be selected for those, or concerts of works by a single composer. There was an All-Prokofiev programme on 24th of March 1963, which was a commemoration of the 10th anniversary of the composer's death. I played half a dozen of a set of short pieces called Vision Fugitive. Thank you. Prokofiev's widow was in the audience, and she came backstage to congratulate us. Another of my appearances in the small hall was following Merzhanov himself. He played the first movement of the Moonlight Sonata, after which I played the second and third movements of the Waldstein Sonata. That was a curious bit of programming, but not untypical of the time. I can only assume that it was an all Beethoven evening. Those were conservatoire internal concerts, but there were also external events, which were often hilarious affairs. At least they seemed to be if I was involved. The off-campus performances were usually at clubs, which were run as social centres for the different professions. The House of Journalists or the House of Actors, these organisations had their own restaurant, reading rooms, and a hall for poetry readings or concerts. The entertainments we were invited, or usually ordered, to take part in, would usually start with an address from a political or military figure. On one occasion, an army general began the evening with an address about the US capitalists and British imperialists. He was later obviously informed that I was English, and at the end of the evening came over to apologise if he had offended me. That was quite extraordinary. In May 1963, I was informed that I was to give a recital in the town of Vladimir, site of a famous prison. Permission had to be granted for me to travel the more than 30 miles from Moscow, and I was taken there by taxi. Concerts in the USSR were always introduced by a master of ceremonies, male or female. Just a few words about the artist and the programme they were to play. My master of ceremonies in Vladimir was a very cheerful man who came to see me in the artist's room just before the start. "This is what I will say," he told me. "This is a recital by the English pianist, winner of international competitions, Alan Fisher." I thought he was joking, so I said, "Fine." But that is exactly how he announced me. He corrected himself before the second half of the programme. Years later, when on tour in the Ukraine, the lady MC also introduced me as Alan Fisher. A case of déjà entendu, perhaps. The day after my Vladimir concert, I was supposed to sit my end-of-year exam. The authorities kindly let me off and, to my surprise, awarded me virtual top marks. Early in 1963, I was told that I had to prepare a programme for the first Leeds International Piano Competition. I was not, and still am not, in favour of competitions, but have had to accept that they are an essential part of the music scene. Of course, I did as I was told and entered, but never held out too much hope of success. For me, spontaneity is an important element in music, and to be successful in competition, you need to have every note in its place and every nuance firmly in your head. And having now had the experience of sitting on music juries, I realise how subjective the judgments are and how often the wrong competitor wins. I was the first to take the stage at 9:30 in the morning and succeeded in reaching the second round, after which only four competitors went forward to the concerto finals. Five Russians also entered, of which only one, Alexei Krainev, got a prize. On our return, I was approached by the head of the piano faculty, Sokolov, and given a bit of a dressing down for not having done better in Leeds. Had I not done my best, it would have been upsetting. Indeed, I had done no worse than the other four Soviet entrants. Anyway, my return to Moscow after Leeds was one occasion when I did not regret putting on the familiar sheepskin coat and going back to meet up with my good friends on the other side of the world. In a way, it was like going home. In March 1963, there was a festival of English musical culture in Moscow. I was able to join the Amadeus String Quartet and Barry Tuckwell, the horn player, for meals in their hotel and on a tour of the Kremlin. I had got to know the Amadeus players through Dennis Matthews when he took me to the Edinburgh Festival in 1960, and we had gone to supper together after their recital. The opening concert of the Moscow Festival was a memorable recital given by Peter Pears, accompanied by Benjamin Britten, featuring songs by Purcell, Schubert and Britten. The Amadeus Quartet followed this the next day with quartets by Mozart, Matthias Schreiber, and Schubert, Death and the Maiden Quartet. The final concert consisted of Britten's Requiem and Serenade for Tenor, Horn and String Orchestra, Purcell's Chaconne and Holst's Planet Suite. Norman Delmar and Britten conducted, with Peter Peers and Barry Tuckwell as soloists. Students were able to ask for passes to all concerts in the big or small halls through the general administrator. Sometimes these were hard to come by, but those of us able to supply a bottle of whiskey or a carton of American cigarettes had less difficulty. Shortly before leaving Moscow, I played in one of Mezhanov's class concerts, performing the Brahms Handel variations at the top of the bill. It was a proud moment for me and a memorable occasion. I played with all the love and respect I felt for my teacher, confident in the knowledge that he had drawn the very best out of me in those 2.5 years. It's true to say that I worked as hard for him as I did for myself. This was a period in my life which taught me so much musically, socially, and politically. It will never be repeated for anyone else because it took place under conditions in the old Soviet Union which are fast disappearing from our memories. It was another world, and one that I could perhaps identify with, having Russian blood in my veins. From 1976, I began regular travel to the Soviet Union for concerts arranged by their concert agency, Goskonzert. These were the first times I'd been there since my student days and gave me the opportunity to see the changes that the country was going through. Things were still tough for the average citizen. On my tours, I was escorted everywhere by an interpreter. Although I spoke enough Russian to get by for everyday matters, it would have been impossible for me to deal with all the problems which arose regarding accommodation, eating, and concert arrangements. Many times we would arrive at a rail station to find that the local concert agent had not been notified of our arrival. And on one occasion, in the Moldovan capital Chisinau, I was informed that I was playing Prokofiev's first piano concerto the next day. That was news to me. My schedule gave me down only for recitals, and I hadn't ever performed that particular concerto in public. I was able to help them out by playing Beethoven's Emperor Concerto instead. I was never aware of the extent to which my lady interpreters took their instructions from the Communist Party, so I was careful not to say anything too derogatory when arrangements were messed up or the hotels were poor. On one of the Lviv visits, my interpreter informed the agent meeting us that I was a vegetarian. "That's no problem," she was told. "There hasn't been any meat in the shops here for the last 3 weeks." In a taxi in Moscow, I talked to the driver in Russian and told him that I had lived there in the early 1960s. I asked him how things were now, to which he responded, "Nothing has changed, but unlike in your country, where you have inflation, here the prices just go up." When some of our contacts apologised for the standard of food or hotels, my interpreter was able to tell them not to worry, I was one of them. In other words, I had lived there long enough to understand. In fact, I did feel like a Russian in many ways due to my heritage, and nowhere more so than in Kaunas, Lithuania. This was the city of my paternal grandparents' birth, the second largest town in Lithuania, and home to a large population of Jews in the latter part of the 19th century. I was truly home. I could remember sitting on my grandfather's knee as a small boy. He died when I was 5, but my grandmother had passed away a year before I was born. Now, here in their birthplace, I could imagine them sitting in the audience listening to me. It was a very special concert for me. I'm sure I gave one of my best performances, certainly the most emotional. Sadly, my father couldn't give me any idea of where in this city my grandparents might have lived, so I was unable to do any detective work. Also, the tight concert schedule precluded sightseeing. However, many of the Soviet concerts were career highlights for me. My first recital in the Philharmonic Hall in Leningrad, playing in the concert hall in Odessa, where the great Emil Gilels regularly played. And crowning them all had to be my debut in the Great Hall of the Moscow Conservatoire in May 1984, when my teacher from 1962, Merzhanov, was in the audience. Thrilling and terrifying in equal measure. My programme was the Mozart Sonata in C, Kochel 279, Schumann's Fantasiestücke, Opus 12, and in the second half, Giles Swain's Variations and the Brahms Handel Variations. The last work was the one I had played at my final Merzhanov class concert. Merzhanov congratulated me warmly, and I felt great pride when I overheard him telling a colleague that he rated my Mozart playing above all others. We went off together, after the recital, to share a glass or two of vodka and to reminisce.
Alan Schiller played Mozart's Piano Sonata in A minor, Kochel 310. Earlier, he performed extracts from Prokofiev's Vision Fugitive, Opus 22. And for Mendelssohn's Piano Trio in D minor, he was joined by the violinist Daphne Moody and the cellist Muriel Daniels. Music Made Me, the Alan Schiller story, was read by the author and produced and recorded in Bristol by Alan Harris.